We get lots of numbers on drug abuse, not so many individual stories. Numbers of drug busts and overdoses and other figures can only tell you so much. Our guest this hour was addicted to drugs and decided to tell her individual story about how she got there and how she got back. Erin Carr calls her memoir Strung Out, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. Erin Carr writes about addiction, recovery, mental health, and more. Her weekly advice column, Ask Erin, is published on Ravishly.com with the subhead, She's Made All the Mistakes, So You Don't Have To. Strung Out is her first book. Erin Carr, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.
You clearly came out of drug abuse with your sense of humor intact. Was it always there?
You know, I mean, there were certainly times when it wasn't. But, you know, it's that old Mark, I believe it's a Mark Twain saying that, you know, tragedy plus time equals comedy. And I think that, you know, we have to look back at some of the dark moments of our lives with a little bit of humor because it's a way of processing it. So I haven't lost my sense of humor, certainly.
That's good. But yeah, it is interesting to look from the remove here, because the events, as you describe them, can be pretty harrowing in the book. But again, mm-hmm. You're here to tell the story. So that's a pretty good indication that things worked out okay.
Yes.
Now, you begin with a personal story, Erin, your 12-year-old son, Atticus, asking if you did drugs. That must have been a moment.
It was definitely a moment. I mean, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew I would have to talk to him about drugs at some point. And certainly he was coming close to the age I was when I started using heroin. I started shortly after my 13th birthday, but I was really shocked in the moment and didn't know how to answer it and evaded the question. And over the next several months, thought about how I wanted to answer the question to him. And that's sort of the framework for the book, is sort of explaining addiction to people who don't understand the psychology behind addiction, and also for people who might be struggling, giving them a sort of reflection and making them feel less alone and giving them hope.
Do you think you would have written the book without Atticus's question, or would have written it later maybe or something?
I may still have written the book because I was already, you know, I was a writer, but I don't know if I would have framed it in the same way and thought about the importance of speaking to our children about the subject. I think that it's really, really important at an early age and in an age-appropriate way. You don't have to go into too much detail, but I think it's important that we open up that dialogue with our kids, not just about addiction, but any sort of mental health struggles that we have, because it leaves the door open for them to come to us when they may be struggling with something.
Well, you know, you mentioned doing heroin at 13, but that was actually not the beginning of your experiences with drugs. How young were
right.
you the first time you grabbed something out of the medicine cabinet?
I was 8 years old. I was having a panic attack, which I didn't know was a panic attack at the time. I didn't have that sort of language for it. I had been experiencing panic attacks. I'd been experiencing a lot of suicidal ideation, was really struggling with that, and not opening up about it or showing it to anyone in my life. I had a lot of friends. I seemed happy on the outside, got perfect grades, but I was really struggling. And one Saturday afternoon, I went into the bathroom, not even sure what I was looking for, opened the medicine cabinet, and there was a bottle of expired painkillers, which I didn't know they were painkillers, but there was an expired bottle in the medicine cabinet that had been sitting there a long time. Nobody really had touched it. And there was a warning label that said may cause drowsiness. I really wanted drowsiness. I wanted some sort of exit from reality and exit from the overwhelming feelings that I didn't know how to process. So I took one. It was a Darvocet. And when the pill took effect, I really liked what it did for me. I liked the distance that it gave me from those feelings. I liked that it allowed me to sort of compartmentalize in a way that I sort of needed at that moment. So over the next few years, I would look for pills in people's medicine cabinets. And again, sort of not knowing what I was looking for, would just look for those warning labels. And this was the 80s, so we didn't have the same sort of child-proof pill bottles then. They were fairly easy for me to get into, and no one certainly suspected that I was pilfering, you know, a pill here and there, and I sort of stashed them away. So by the time I got to that moment where I was offered heroin, I was really constantly looking for an escape. It really accelerated for me in adolescence.
Well, and this is an interesting circumstance. So you were 13 when you got heroin. You were dating a 16-year-old guy who thought you were 15. You asked him for pills. Mm-hmm. He said, have you ever done heroin? Broaden the picture a bit, though. This was not in a dirty alley behind a flop house.
No. I mean, I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles. I went to a prep school. I was a cheerleader, a volleyball player. I horseback rode. I met him on a ski trip in Mammoth, and we had kept in touch, and he asked me out. I said yes. I lied to my mom, told her I was going to spend the night at a friend of mine who I rode horses with. He picked me up and drove me to his house. He lived in Beverly Hills in an area called the Truesdale Estate, sort of looking down on Beverly Hills, and his parents weren't home. This was definitely not sort of, I didn't fit the demographic, especially at that time, of what a drug user looked like or what sort of socioeconomic background they came from. And, you know, truthfully, that is what enabled me to stay hidden for as long as I did. I really hid this for a decade before the majority of people in my life found out, including my family.
So interesting. So I mean, did you have any thoughts about the kinds of people who did drugs? I mean, you mentioned you're not in that demographic, but did you think about the demographic that did?
I mean, I don't know how cognizant I was of it at 13. I was definitely well-read. I started reading at a really early age, and I read a lot of adult books. So I had read about addiction. I knew a little bit about heroin. I had been really obsessed with the Velvet Underground. So I kind of like understood it in this abstract sort of way, but I certainly didn't have an understanding of the ramifications, nor did I fully connect that with sort of like the images that I saw in film.
I want to come back to and finish up the discussion about the drug demographic. You know, kids, because they are kids, can say fairly unkind things and make very broad and nasty assumptions about people. I just wondered if you had some sort of vocabulary of druggies or something that you thought of as the people who did drugs and just didn't connect what you were doing to them.
I mean, I certainly was cognizant of the fact that I was doing drugs, but I was aware of the fact that the privileges that I had, which was, you know, I had some financial privilege, and because I was outside of that demographic, I did understand that that protected me from some of the side effects of drug use. I mean, I was never arrested. All of those sorts of factors, I had some awareness of, not as much as I have now, obviously, but I did have some awareness of that. And I don't know, I think that I knew inherently that I wasn't any different than a person doing, you know, shooting drugs on the street. But it certainly allowed me to keep up this facade for a much, much longer.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about you were a cheerleader, a horseback rider, played mm-hmm. volleyball, you're a big reader, came from some financial privilege as well. But, you know, no home is perfect. You had some tensions at home. Tell mm-hmm. us particularly about your mother's relationship.
So I had, I was close to my mom, but we definitely had ups and downs in our relationship. My parents had separated, and my mom was struggling with her own, depression and processing the divorce. And I think that, when my parents divorced, it was a lot easier to know for them that everything was okay because I showed them that everything was okay on the outside. Now, ironically, when they did think that something was going on with me, it was when I stopped using drugs for periods of time. So, for example, shortly before my 15th birthday, I stopped using drugs and I started just having a lot of emotional volatility. Well, my parents noticed this and did put me into therapy right away. And I was able to go to therapy with my mother as well, which was extremely beneficial. And although we still had, some issues over the years, it was really helpful. And it's taught me a lot now as a parent that when I went to therapy with my mom, she was able to listen to me sort of unload everything that I felt and validate it and not get defensive and apologize to me. And that was a huge, huge deal. And I think it's so important, and I've learned this now as a parent, that we show our kids that yes, we are their parents, but when we're parents, we don't stop being these imperfect humans that we were before we became parents. I have a really good relationship with both of my parents now. They've both read the book, and certainly I think that you know, if they could go back in time, were there things that they would have done differently? Of course. But, you know, we're here where we are now, and I'm really grateful for the relationship that we have, you know, despite whatever had been going on then and in whatever ways that maybe I felt neglected. When it came time for me to, in my 20s, when I really needed help, my parents were there for me. They never turned their backs on me.
But at 13, it was kind of a different story. Was there anyone in your family, in your life, who was a particularly stable and predictable for you, some adult mentor?
I mean, my grandmother definitely was, but she passed away shortly after my 14th birthday, and that was a major blow to me. I had a therapist at the time that I stopped using drugs and was having a lot of problem regulating my emotions. I saw a therapist who really, really helped me. And my mom had a boyfriend later on, like actually more like after I moved out of the house, but I was still a teenager because I moved out when I was 16, who was very helpful to me as well. There were people around there. You know, I was extremely lucky. As much as maybe our family was dysfunctional and there were issues there, I still did have a support system that a lot of people struggling with addiction don't have. And, you know, I always like to point that out, that even with all the support that I had, financial, emotional, in friends and family, it still took me a very long time to climb my way out of addiction. And I think it's important to understand that when we're looking at people where we think, oh my gosh, why can't they just get it? You know, and it's a process, and it requires a long-term plan of aftercare and support.
Well, as you point out, I mean, you had a lot of advantages, but even mm-hmm. you didn't just get it. I mean, it's just not like that. Erin Carr is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Strung Out, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. It wasn't just drugs. You pointed out in attempting to regulate your emotions, you looked for relief in lots of different ways.
Yes. I mean, I definitely looked for relief in ways of like shopping, definitely in my romantic relationships. There's definitely a pattern you can see between the way that I was in relationships and, you know, I had a lot of them and I was not, there was a lot of infidelity on my part, a lot of lying on my part. And it's very similar behavior that was in line with using drugs. All of it was really an attempt to keep people at a distance from me because emotional intimacy was the scariest thing in the world. You know, I think that for a lot of people, not just for people struggling with addiction, but especially people struggling with addiction, there's so much shame that we're carrying around that it can feel like extremely, extremely scary to have anybody really see us. Because if, you know, there's this sort of primal fear that like, if they knew X about me, they wouldn't love me. And I think that certainly was true for me. I was petrified of anyone really getting too close to me because I was afraid that if they did, they'd see who I really was and they wouldn't love me. And that perpetuated a lot of destructive behavior on my part.
It sounds like a good recipe for relationship sabotage.
Yes, I sabotaged every relationship.
And then you can turn around and go, oh, why don't they love me?
Right, right. Well, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You know, we have, I think very early on, and again, this goes for people that, even for people that don't struggle with addiction, we often have belief systems that we create for ourselves based on, sometimes it's based on just our personality we're born with, maybe some physiological differences in the brain, and then also it's environment. So whatever happens in early childhood can create these belief systems we have about ourselves, and we subconsciously continually do things behaviorally that reinforce that belief system. And I couldn't see that in the moment, but now, you know, it's been 17 years since I used drugs. So I have some time and distance and I've done a lot of work on myself. And it's so clear to me now, the path that I went on, it wasn't in the moment.
did you do some cutting too? Is that what I read in the book?
Yes. I also had some cutting behavior. I didn't go too far with that because I was, you know, I didn't want to cut so much that people would notice it, but I had cutting behavior. Any way that I could hurt myself, I would look for ways to hurt myself. I had that feeling constantly that I had so much self-hatred that I really wanted to just tear myself out of my own skin. Or, you know, I had moments when I was really struggling where I'd sit on my hands because I wanted to just jump through the window and I didn't trust that I wouldn't do it. So, you know, I think that's something that a lot of people who are struggling with mental health problems or with addiction can relate to. And I think that, you know, there's sort of a myth that people who become drug addicts, it's because, oh, they wanted to party and they didn't think about the consequences and they just wanted to get high. And it was never about getting high for me. And I believe that that's true for a lot of people. I read something years ago about gambling addiction, and they said that gambling addicts play to lose, not to win, that they can't stop until they lose. And losing is sort of the goal subconsciously. And I think that that's true for me with my addiction, is that I just couldn't stop until I got lower and lower and lower and lower. And I think that that can be something that's difficult for people to understand from the outside. But I'm hoping that the way in which I presented my story in the book will help people have a different lens on addiction.
Erin Carr is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She writes about addiction and her own cycle to the bottom. Her book is called Strung Out, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. You're welcome to join our conversation on the Exchange. Ask Erin some questions about her own experience or share yours if you have something in your own life or someone close to you that compares with what we're talking about here. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, taking up heroin at age 13, which I'm sure is going to shock a few people who read this book or just hear about it. Did you feel in those early days that you could handle heroin or manage your use of it or something?
I certainly thought I was doing a good job of it for some time. I mean, I had, you know, in all my years of using, except, you know, maybe towards the very end, I implemented a lot of sort of control mechanisms. You know, those early years, for a long time, only used it on weekends. And then during the week, I wouldn't bring it home. And then, of course, at a certain point, I started bringing it home. And I always pushed and pushed and pushed to keep up that outside facade so that I could hide it.
So you did stop for a time, removing what you call the thick protective coating of heroin. I mean, without it, how did you cope with the changes in your life, which, of course, at age 13 are going to come pretty fast and furious, and then in your life a little more so?
I did not cope with them well, which is how I, you know, why my parents noticed, you know, and put me in therapy. The therapy did help. I definitely horseback riding was a big outlet for me and something that really helped me process feelings and decompress, and was a very sort of meditative hobby for me. And, you know, I did lean on my friends to a certain degree, but I was always keeping people at a distance because the people closest to me didn't even know that I had ever been doing drugs. Later on, I did tell people and then lied about it when I started up again. But, you know, I think that my ongoing problem when I wasn't on drugs is that I could not regulate my emotions. And when I was on drugs, I could regulate my emotions. So the times that I was using, people thought that everything seemed okay. And the times that I wasn't, people were concerned.
You write extensively about your mom taking you to the therapist. You've mentioned this a few times already. It sounds like it was very good for you, but got a bit close to the part of you that you'd worked very hard to keep hidden.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. There's a, you know, there's, and I write about this in the book, there's something that always stood out for me. I always walked around feeling sort of taking responsibility for everything, saying, oh, no, it's my fault, right? Thinking that everything was my fault, whether I verbalized that or not. And in therapy, one day, my therapist said, you know, I noticed that you say that you feel guilty a lot. Why do you think that is? And I said, well, because I have a lot to feel guilty about. And he said, all that guilt is unexpressed anger, which made me angry. And I sort of like brushed off what he said because I knew that he was right to a certain degree. I worked very hard not to express anger, not to express sadness in front of people because I didn't want them to know that that existed in me. I had built up such a wall around myself that I didn't want anyone to know that I was affected by them.
Was there some guide in your family? Did you come from one of those stiff upper lip families, or one of the like throw things against the wall families, or somewhere in the middle of that continuum?
I mean, somewhere in the middle. I mean, certainly my father was not somebody that was really good about talking about his emotions. He was very successful in his career, had worked, you know, from the ground up and became very successful, and was the type of person that if anything emotional came up would kind of like make it into a joke. My mom and I were close and would have sort of heartfelt talks, but I still hid things from her. And I think that at an early age, and maybe part of this was with my parents' divorce, and there was a period of time where my mother, when I was very young, my mother lost her father and went through some depression herself. And I felt like I didn't want to add any more unhappiness to my parents, and felt this responsibility always to sort of be the person tap dancing in the corner, like, look at me, hey, woo, you know, it's, everything's good. And I did that, you know, in my friend groups. My joke is like, I started talking at like 18 months and I never shut up. I always was chatter, always like that, always very social, always trying to fill the silences with activity and chatter and noise, because that was sort of how I thought I'd keep everybody afloat.
Yeah, that's fairly common in families of alcoholics. The whole mm-hmm. mascot person who feels like they have to entertain to draw attention away from the crisis in the house that's always there.
Right.
So, you mentioned moving out of the house, Aaron, when mm-hmm. you were 16. What was going on with you and education or employment as you got to that point in your teen years?
Well, I ended up graduating early. I had enough credits to graduate other than religion classes. I was at a Catholic school, and my English teacher at the time really advocated for me to graduate early. So I did. And I ended up going to USC in LA, and I didn't want to live in the dorm. And, you know, at that point, I had gotten pretty good at emotionally manipulating my father to sort of get what I wanted in terms of material things, it was a double-edged sword for me, because I had attached a lot of what I associated with his way of showing love to me based on what he gave me, but then I also sort of carried a lot of shame about it because I felt I didn't deserve it because of all of sort of the feelings I had about myself. So we had this pattern going on, and I sort of said that if, you know, that he had to get me my own apartment, that I couldn't live with my mom, and that if he didn't help me get an apartment, I would start stripping to support myself, which is like a completely, you know, awful and manipulative thing to say, but it got me what I wanted. So I moved out and moved into an apartment and started going to school and was supported by my dad.
So would you actually have considered stripping for money, or was it just a ploy for your dad?
I don't know. I did not think that he wouldn't come through in that way. I had been, you know, as much as maybe I wasn't always emotionally supported, my dad usually came through if there was something that I wanted to do or have. You know, I think we've talked about this so much now. I mean, of course, like, he would do things differently now, but, you know, it is what it is. That's how it went.
How diplomatic, Aaron, did you have to be with your parents in giving them the manuscript? Or did you let them see it before you did the final version?
I did not let them see it until I had the advanced copies that were being distributed to book critics and early reviewers and press. I sent them the advanced copy. So it was not at the point that anything could really be changed. And I was very careful in the book, and I think that I accomplished this, of keeping it about my lens and my story, so that I wasn't filling in the blanks for what their story was. You know, there's certainly a lot of things that I left out of the big picture because it wasn't my story to tell. Mm-hmm. So I really was careful about how I portrayed people, and I wanted to always portray people as honestly as possible without telling their story for them and without throwing anyone under the bus. Mm-hmm. And always putting the harshest light on myself because that's the only one that I really felt that I had a right to put that harsh light on.
So a bit of a shift in location part of the way into your life and therefore in the book, off to Paris, living the dream, no drugs. What subbed for the drugs when you were living in Paris?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, certainly you could argue that it was sort of my romantic relationships that substituted the drugs there for a while. But I think I also was really earnestly trying to make a fresh start and find myself again in this new city. It's a time of my life that was both wonderful and heartbreaking, but I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
All right, so you came back to L.A. with Vincent from Paris when the relationship and the sex turned sour. Which drug did you pick up first?
Well, I had started sort of dabbling again with some crystal meth, but then I went back to heroin.
Okay, and how did you ended up being a daily heroin doser, didn't you?
Yeah, so pretty quickly when I started using again after he had gone back to France, this was in end of 1996. A lot of people at that time in Los Angeles were using heroin again very casually, and they were smoking it. And it seemed more innocuous to me somehow. So I started using again and at first started just smoking it and then went back to using a needle again. And it escalated for me very quickly. You know, within probably the space of 6 weeks, I was using every day. And it that was probably my heaviest in terms of just daily usage because I wasn't really moored to a serious relationship at that period of time. So I didn't have to hide it from anybody I was living with.
How did you afford daily heroin?
Well, I was working and I was going to school and I was working and making decent money. I was working as a wardrobe stylist for commercials. And then my father was still supporting me for sort of all my basic expenses. So all of the money that I made working was going towards drugs.
Wow. Now, you've touched on this earlier, but the image of you essentially just, you know, driving up and buying drugs on a street corner, you know, and it registers at this point in the book about how being white and somewhat privileged gave you some space.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that if my skin had been darker, my story would be very different. You know, people of color have traditionally, historically, and still are arrested and incarcerated at a astronomically higher rate than white people.
Heroin itself doesn't care who it devastates, though. Can you describe what being dope sick feels like?
The way I would describe it is combining a flu with every single muscle in your body sort of contracting and spasming. Your entire body hurts, your nose is runny, often vomiting, having diarrhea, the chills, sweating profusely, everything sort of trying to come out of your body at once. And the psychological part of it is what's the worst, because you know there's that part of your brain that is like, if you just had some heroin, you wouldn't feel like this. You would stop being sick. And that psychological component is so awful because you are so desperate in those moments to not be sick, which is why it's so hard for people to detox. You know, even people who are not, you know, clinically addicts that have physical dependencies, say they had a surgery and they had to be on medication for some time. I have a friend that had back surgery. She's not an addict. She was on pain medication for maybe 6 weeks. When she tapered down off of it, she had a weekend where she said it was the worst weekend of her life. And she called me and she said, I can't believe you went through this again and again and again. It was awful. And I think that it's hard for people to really understand how awful that feeling is. You know, people often ask me now, you know, do I still get cravings? Do I ever worry about going back? And really, like, I would rather not be here anymore than ever go through withdrawal again. That is the worst feeling in the world. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And when I think about heroin or opiates in general, I cannot think about them without thinking of that consequence.
The vignette in the book where you're dealing with the effects of being dope sick, and you have this green sweater on that it's you're alternately too hot and too cold, and you take it off and put it on, and can you wear a green sweater to this day? It's so vivid.
Well, I don't think I've bought a sweater in that color since then, but yes, I mean I can remember that feeling. Like if I sit here and close my eyes, I know what that feeling is like. I can feel it. I can conjure that up. You know, the sense memories of heroin for me when I sat down to write this book are so vivid, so, so vivid that I had no problem accessing those memories because the sense memories are so strong.
So what or who finally got you to rehab?
Well, I went to rehab twice. So the first time I went to rehab, Vincent, who was my French fiance, who we ended up getting back together, he became my fiance, and he didn't know I was using, caught me in the act, and I went to rehab the first time. We split up, and then for the next 5 years, I was in a cycle of continually relapsing, hiding it from people, just over and over and over again. I went to rehab again a second time, and I still used after that. When I was 28, I found out that I was pregnant, and against all better judgment and everyone's advice, I decided I was going to have the baby. I was using at the time. I found a doctor that was willing to detox me, and I made a commitment to stay sober for the duration of the pregnancy. I had very little faith that I would be able to stay away from drugs. I think, you know, my family certainly didn't have faith that I'd be able to stay away from drugs. The baby's father, who I married at the time, who was not a drug addict, didn't have faith that I would be able to stay away from drugs. And I was very ambivalent about the pregnancy. But the moment that I had Atticus and I held him for the first time, I had a real lightning bolt moment for myself where I looked at this new baby and I had the overwhelming thought just coursing through me that I love you more than I hate myself. And I know that that sounds very sort of simplistic. That's not how I stayed sober, but it was the impetus that I needed to do the work so that I wouldn't go back to drugs, and I never did. And, you know, part of that is because I had access to care. When I made that commitment, I was able to go to therapy. I was able to see a psychiatrist. I was able to have support, both financial and emotional, from my family. And it made all the difference in the world. I really had to address the mental health issues that were at the root of my addiction. I had had some childhood trauma as well that I needed to address and process and work through. And that is really the reason that I was able to keep sober and to stay away from drugs.
The numbness you sought from the earliest days, from taking pills out of the medicine cabinet at 8 years old, moving on to heroin at 13, you were trying to keep bad feelings away. I mean, so without drugs, did you feel good feelings more intensely too?
Oh, yeah, I think so, for sure. I mean, I definitely, you know, I didn't believe it was possible for me. Even when I made that commitment to stay sober, I didn't believe it was possible for me to have any length of time where I would be happy in life or not feel like I wanted to kill myself. I am happy. You know, it doesn't mean I'm happy all the time, but in general, I'm happy in my life. More importantly, I'm satisfied with my life. I feel optimistic about my life. And I never thought that that was possible for me. I really, really didn't. That is the miracle for me, even more than staying away from the drugs, that I am able to have a life today where I feel happiness and a life today where I'm able to sit through extreme pain and discomfort. And I don't mean physical, I mean emotional, and not use. You know, I've walked through, you know, delivering a premature stillborn child, all sorts of events, life events that I never thought I'd be able to handle, I've been able to handle. And that's a huge deal.
Talk, if you would, Aaron, about how you view your own experience when compared with other Americans caught up in the opioid epidemic. And you make it clear from the beginning that part of the reason you wrote this book was to give people a story, a personal story to connect to.
Well, I think with the opioid crisis, you know, certainly it's in the news cycle constantly. As of February of this year, the current statistics are that 128 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose. That doesn't include other people dying from other substance use disorders. So that's over 46,000 people a year in America dying from opioid overdoses. That is a staggering number. And I think when we see these images on TV, you know, we've certainly seen that the pictures and images of people passed out on the street like zombies in the back of a car with a baby, all these sorts of images, we start to forget that they are human beings and see caricatures. And the thing that I constantly message in the book and when I speak publicly about the subject is that addiction is not a moral failing. It is a public health crisis. These are human beings struggling with a very human condition. And I think that when we remember that, when we remember that there is a human being underneath all of that addiction and all of the behaviors around addiction that we find so upsetting, when we remember the human being there who is suffering, we can treat it from a different place and we can have more empathy and compassion. There is nobody that is, as a small child says, when I grow up, I want to be, you know, a junkie. I want to be strung out and I want to be a drug addict living on the streets. Nobody has that dream for themselves. They were once a kid that had big dreams for themselves. And I think that we need to remember that constantly, to treat it as we would any other health crisis. When somebody has cancer and a certain medication protocol doesn't work, we switch to another protocol. And I think we need to do the same thing with addiction. There's not a one-size-fits-all treatment. We really need to be willing to meet people where they're at, to focus on, number one, keeping them alive, because you can't help somebody recover if they're dead, which is why harm reduction services are so important, and try different strategies to bring people into recovery and have long-term aftercare in place.
Aaron's figure, by the way, just let me tell the audience here, 128 people dying in the United States is a 2018 figure from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I just checked it out myself. The figures are unbelievably shocking, but life, you know, is really awful for some people. What kinds of things can you say to people who think that drugs might be a necessary balance for that?
I mean, I understand that impulse. I think that it is really hard when you feel like you can't get out of bed in the morning, or if you're living on the street. If everything is so bad and bleak, where is the motivation, right? I can tell you this. Yes, I had that family support, and I had privileges that many people do not have. But I have seen people with nothing who had lost everything that everyone was convinced would never recover. I have seen those people recover and have lives that are unimaginable today. The thing that I want to tell people is that there is always hope. As long as they are still alive, there is always hope.
Atticus is what, 16 now, your son, your older
son?
Yeah,
he's 16.
Mm-hmm. Have you had that frank conversation about why people use drugs?
Oh, yeah. So we ended up having that first conversation right before his 13th birthday, which was amazing. And the first thing he said to me, you know, I told him the truth without going into too much detail about, you know, what I was struggling with mentally at the time and that I had started using heroin at 13. And then when I was done talking, he gave me a hug and just said, "Mom, I'm so sorry you had to go through that."
Wow.
And in the years since, he's had questions and I've answered them. And, you know, we keep the conversation going.
Good. All right. The book is called Strung Out, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. Erin Carr wrote it. She writes about addiction, recovery, mental health, and a whole lot more. Her weekly advice column is called Ask Erin. She's made all the mistakes, so you don't have to. That's at ravishly.com. Erin, thank you so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.